Thank you, Shannon, very much. As we discussed the theme for this in our staff, I remembered that 52 years ago in this month, I had my final meeting with Bishop Walter Gray, who was himself a Virginian, but the last Prince Bishop of Connecticut, a man of very real substance and a very intimidating person. And I remember, as I sat in his office, nervously awaiting what he was going to tell me about diaconal ordination, he looked over the top of his glasses and he said, "Well, Elof, I am aware you have a problem with authority, but I'm going to ordain you anyway." So 52 years later, I trust that Bishop Gray is looking down, and I hope he's pleased that I don't think I've had a huge problem with authority. I did have some problems with his style of authority, and so I didn't argue with him. He was right about that, and that may become apparent in some of what I'm going to say. Because as I've thought about this subject, I'm aware that all of us who are ordained have authority, but none of us have authority on our own. To the degree that any of us have authority, we have it in the authority of Jesus Christ. And we need to look to Jesus to see where the roots of authority lie. In the New Testament, the most used word for Jesus' moral influence over other people, his authority, is exousia. It usually is translated as authority, but it can also be translated as power. We see it in Mark 1:22 and in the two synoptic passages that parallel that Mark passage, when Jesus wows the people early in his ministry in Capernaum, and they say he speaks with exousia, with authority, and not as the scribes. We see it again in places like Matthew 7:28-29, when the crowds were amazed at his teachings and began to say to each other, "Where does he get this exousia, his authority?" In Matthew 9:6, Jesus has exousia to forgive sins. This comes in the context of his healing a paralyzed person. Again, in Matthew 21:23-27, when the chief priests interrogate Jesus before his trial, they are interrogating him about his exousia, his authority. But Jesus isn't the only one with authority in the New Testament. It also occurs in Luke 4:6, when the devil's authority is referred to in his tempting of Jesus. The word there is exousia, and usually translated as power. But somewhere in that dialogue, we begun to realize that Jesus has more power than the devil. So there's a difference. In commissioning his disciples, Jesus gives them the authority. In Mark 6:7, the 12 are given exousia to cast out impure spirits. Sometimes it is difficult to understand how this relates to power, because it seems that Jesus isn't necessarily, in his authority, exercising power. We get a clue for this, even though the word exousia is not used, in John 18:33-38. It's the scene where Jesus is being tried by Pilate, and where he says, "My kingdom is not of this world," which should give us a clue that Jesus' authority, whatever else it is not exactly like that of the world. So how does authority, as Jesus has it, differ from power? We see that in some of our English usages also of the word authority. There are authorities. These are often experts in a particular field. The scribes fell into that particular category. They were authorities on Torah. Jesus was not an authority on Torah, although he clearly spoke about Torah, and he sometimes reinterpreted it. But he had authority, something which the hearers of Jesus did not think that the scribes had. There are authorities who police and regulate our lives. We often refer to turning people over to the authorities when they are being arrested or when they're going to court. But Jesus didn't exercise that kind of authority at all. There are authorities who wield dramatic power, kings and presidents and dictators. But this kind of authority is very alien to what we see in Jesus. His authority, I firmly believe, was firmly rooted in his authenticity. It's interesting that the word authority and authenticity both have the same root word. But it's his authenticity that set Jesus apart. And authenticity is being the real thing. We use that in relationship to someone or something that rings true. Something that just so obviously is true for us. When people are living their truest kind of life, we realize that they are authentic. In Jesus, there was no hypocrisy. There was no dichotomy between what he said and what he did. He had an authentic life. He was the real thing. His authenticity enabled him to speak, I think, with authority. Anyone who exercises power is usually seen as an authority, but it's interesting that the two things are hardly the same. No, power and authority are not the same thing, for in fact, although persons who exercise power may in fact be able to engender fear and even compliance, people who exercise authority engender respect. Jesus had that kind of authority, the kind of authority that gave him respect. He wasn't an expert. He didn't exercise much worldly power. He was God incarnate, so in a sense that gave him a special kind of power and authority. But we experience his power not in the show of force, but in the show of love. Which is why in yesterday's gospel, Jesus admonishes his followers to love others as he has loved them. And how has he loved them? Self-sacrificially. Self-sacrificial love, ultimately for the Christian, is the most powerful thing in the world. It has power to transform our lives. Mercifully, probably most of the people in this room, their lives have been transformed somewhere along the line by the power of that love exercised through other people. It has the power to transform our world. When I became a bishop 22 years ago, I realized almost immediately that bishops in the Episcopal Church do not have much actual power. But it wasn't a great surprise to me because years before, when I became rector of a parish, I began to realize that also. Rector, as most of you know, especially if you are rector, you should know, rector comes from the Latin that means ruler. But only the most delusional among us imagine that the priest in charge is actually the one who has the power in the parish. Power in the parish necessarily is shared. And it's interesting, I like the phrase that the previous Archbishop of Canterbury used about the church being constituencies not of our own choosing. The leadership of most of our parishes, in my experience, are not the people we would have chosen to help lead with us. So it requires a great deal of give and take. They are constituencies somewhere along the line of God's choosing. Now, bishops, priests, and deacons do have authority. But they need to come by this authority in a very different way. It doesn't happen at our ordination, or at our institution, or, Lord knows, at our consecration. Authority must be earned. And part of the way in which it's earned is through humility, hard work, honesty, serving in love with those whom we companion in the church. Authority is based, as it is for Jesus, on our authenticity. I was very blessed to find out early on in my priesthood that I could say almost anything as long as I was being authentic. people would forgive me if they didn't agree, and they would still enfold me, especially if I was enfolding them. The criterion wasn't agreement. The criterion was trying to be authentic. In our three orders, bishops, priests, and deacons, deacons are particularly blessed because there is little presumption that deacons will wield power. And that is a blessing. They are servant leaders. They are modeling their servant leadership on Christ and calling the whole church to be servants, which is exactly what all Christians are called to be, is to be servants. It's not quite as simple for priests and bishops. In my experience, conscientious deacons speak with great authority. And the reason for this is because they are squarely in the world. And if they're conscientious, they're living into their ordination vow. So they are primarily interested in interpreting to the church the needs of the world. And part of the problem for priests and bishops is we often become preoccupied with interpreting the needs of the church to the church. And then we wonder why we have so little authority in the world. My authority and yours has to be earned by our integrity, by our degree of self-sacrificing love, our being there for people, being dependable, knowing that we are someone that they can trust, our respect for other persons who are the children of God, even when they are very different from us, and especially if they have different points of view. It has a lot to do with getting some of the junk of our own lives out of the way, so that somewhere in us, people get a glimmer of the Lord Jesus Christ. That's really what our authority is all about. Only with the help of the Holy Spirit can we have this authority. And we aren't the only ones who have to earn authority. Think back to the teachers who most influenced your life. I would be willing to bet that none of them were the most authoritarian teachers you've ever had. Most of them, I would think, were people who loved their subject, were really interested in learning and in teaching, who loved what they did and clearly loved their pupils, albeit they were probably also hard taskmasters making real demands. At least those are the qualities I think of the teachers that I still cherish these days. They earned their authority because they were living into their vocation. I've always liked Fred Buechner's definition of vocation, when our deep joys meet the world's deep needs. And good teachers know this. Their vocation is their deep joy comes from teaching, which is meeting a world's deep need. Parents also, if you think about it, have to earn authority. That may not be as obvious as it is with teachers, but it's nonetheless true. Simply cracking the whip doesn't do the job. Just being a disciplinarian doesn't do the job. Just loving your child, that could mean many things, doesn't really do the job. Parents have to struggle somehow to both love their child, affirm their child, but also exercise discipline with that child and correct the child. And if it's done with a modicum of grace, chances are the child will grow up to respect the authority of the parents. So the mere fact that a parent has legal authority over their children doesn't amount for much in the final analysis. It's really the way in which the parenting has been done which engenders a deeper sense of that authority. I'm going to rapidly close this, but I do want to say just a word or two, and then I want to open it up for discussion. I lived in New England for 47 years, and even by New England standards, I have always been outspoken. So I hope that's not too intimidating here in Virginia. It seemed to fly in Maryland perfectly all right. But I have over the years, I've had to learn to be more diplomatic. I have had to learn to not say everything that crosses my mind. But I think the way, I mean, you might ask, how have I gotten away with this for 51 years? Because I've served in five different dioceses and a number of different parishes, some of which were very diverse, and two of which had a sizable number of very conservative people. So here I am, a person who has always, in 51 years, come out on the very progressive side of all of the hot-button issues. I'm fairly conservative theologically, but I am not at all conservative when it comes to social issues, and especially issues of justice. So how have I gotten away with it? I've had to ask that question myself, because I'm a little amazed sometimes that I have been able to do it in so many different contexts. And I think the reason is that I learned very early on that it was very important to not let the issues become what defined me as a priest, but to let the love which I shared and my respect for the people with whom I was working take the high road, and then they could accept the difference. Often with the comment, I still get people who comment to me, "Bishop, I couldn't disagree with you more, but I respect you as a person." That means a lot to me. I would much rather have them respect me than agree with me. And I'm aware that in the time that I was a priest and bishop, I went through all of the major wars of the Episcopal Church, starting way back before many of you were ordained, with the liturgical wars, which now seem like small potatoes, but at the time they loomed large. This was the trial liturgies and various things that were used prior to the present prayer book, which is still referred to in many of our churches as the new prayer book. And I try not to roll my eyes to heaven and think, "How long, O Lord?" you know. But if you didn't live through that period, you don't know how exercised people got about the loss of the 1928 prayer book. There was a Society for the Preservation of the Book of Common Prayer. People left the Episcopal Church because they couldn't stand the new liturgies. I had the dubious distinction of pulling the altar out from the wall in three of the churches I served. And that was a hot-button issue at the time, nothing compared to some later hot-button issues. And it's helpful to remember that at the very same time, the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement were going on, and I was deeply involved in all of those. But something to illustrate what I'm saying is, I remember the day, one of many days, that I marched against the war in Vietnam. I was in Manchester, Connecticut. I was in a neighboring parish of Bolton. One of my favorite parishioners had an insurance company that was right on the route. And I remember him coming out specifically to yell at me to go back to the church, get off the street. I was on the wrong side of the issue. It didn't change our relationship. I was saying what I needed to say from my own conscience, and he was saying what he had to say from his conscience. It didn't distance us. I was a very good friend of his son, who was my age. About 3 years later, I buried him. And I have to admit, it was one of the few times that at the interment, after I had finished what I had to say, I broke down in tears, because this was a wonderful human being. I mean, he was a wonderful Christian man. And despite our differences, we had great respect for each other. So those things are possible. And then, of course, that was followed by the ordination of women, which was a divisive issue for some people in the church. And that was in turn followed by the sexuality wars. I had the distinction of being Bishop of Maryland during the height of the sexuality wars, which was okay. I think I was well equipped for it. And even though I had long been an advocate for the ordination of gay and lesbian persons, and even for the blessing of same-sex unions prior to my becoming a bishop, one of the things I did was to pledge to myself in all of the search processes I have ever been in parishes or in dioceses, that I would be who I was. I would try to be authentic and not try to give cagey answers that would somehow maybe endear me to people who had different points of view. And I think I'm probably living proof of the fact that it didn't scar me over much. In fact, many people, when I was elected in Maryland, who were not liberal, were very relieved that I was a candidate who actually spoke my mind, who said where I was, but also made it very clear it has been an important part of my ministry to make sure that minority voices are always at the table, that they are listened to respectively, and that the persons making those are enfolded in love as loved members of the Church of God, certainly as loved by God as God loves me. So that has been a healthy way of trying to work on my own authority, and I think it's worked. So I share that just as a kind of way of ending this little discussion. I have a rabbi friend who always says, nobody ever asks the first question or makes the first comment, so I'll entertain the second comment or the second question at this time. And I would like this to be I don't want it just questions and answers. I don't have all the answers, but I think there are probably all the answers we need are in this room. I'm sure of that. Anyone want to pick up on any part of that? Or so close after dinner, I put you all to sleep. So.